Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Talking Natural Capital, a podcast from Galbraith. I'm your host, as always, Matt Findlay, and I'm delighted to be joined by natural capital and carbon leader at Galbraith, Eleanor Harris. Eleanor, welcome. Are you looking forward to getting your podcast hat back on today?
Yes, hello. It's lovely to be back. Lovely to have a new guest.
Yeah, well, a little bit about our guest today, Nikki Yoxall. Nikki, welcome to Talking Natural Capital.
Thanks for having me.
And can you just tell us a little bit about why we've got you on today and what you do?
Sure. So I would call myself a grazier. I live in Aberdeenshire, but I'm also an educator, academic. I'm currently doing a PhD, which looks at the role of nature connection in the agroecological transition and the role that plays on decision making on farm. And I also do some work with Pasture for Life, supporting research into 100% pasture fed ruminant systems. But at home, I run Grampian Graziers with my husband, James, where we produce 100% pasture fed beef from native breed cattle. But we work with other people and use their land to do that, using the cattle as ecological engineers to promote ecological functioning and biodiversity gains.
Excellent. So a lot of hats then.
Yeah, quite busy.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to today's discussion. I'm going to hand over to Eleanor for the opening question as we kick off today's show.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm really pleased to have Nikki on today. I suspect some of our listeners, I discovered Nikki on social media and her wonderful photos, hashtag the wee mob, who are the cows. And I've been wanting to have a chat with you for ages because you've got so many hats, and I like people who wear lots of hats. You seem to be putting into practice the stuff that you're researching, which I like. You're joining up research and practice. I think that's my first question, is which came first, that you're a researcher who decided to get your hands dirty, or a grazier who decided to find out more, or is it really both going along at the same time? How did you get to this multi-hatted role that you've got?
Yeah, I would say it's a co-evolution. So my background is in teaching rather than research. So I've been working in the further and higher education sector for about 15 years. And before moving to Scotland, my job was head of land-based at an agricultural college in the southeast of England. And I got into that kind of a circuitous route via teaching, but also kind of my equine horsey background, which got me into that role. But whilst in that role, discovered that I loved the farm more than anywhere else on the college site. And I lived on site as well. And that meant that I was able to kind of get quite involved in the farm. And then when we moved to Scotland, I really missed that. And so although I was working in education up here, we had bought a house with a small amount of land and really recognised that cattle were going to be the ideal tool to help us to manage the land here. So we discovered holistic management, which is a management framework for decision making and is really helpful in a kind of land-based ecological setting. So started using holistic management to help us to drive towards a more abundant and diverse landscape at home, using cattle to do that. And I then sort of shifted in my education role into a more kind of towards research, did a master's in sustainable food and natural resources, and then was very luckily given the opportunity to do a PhD. So at that point, I left my education kind of management leadership role that I was in with the University of Highlands and Islands, and kind of went more full time into agri-food systems research and practice. So farming, working with Pasture for Life to help them progress their research aims, but also alongside that, my own PhD. So the kind of ability to step from predominantly education with a bit of farming on the side into a more balanced land management research role was something that I couldn't kind of not take up.
When I first started, you came onto my radar, I was working with foresters, with the forestry industry. And so what I was struck by was how many pictures you had of cows in trees. And this is still this is seen as quite a slightly crazy thing to do in the UK. We tend to keep our cows and our trees in separate places. Foresters and farmers are different disciplines, and you've sort of smashed the two together, and you're a big advocate. What is so special about cows in trees?
Yeah, well, there's so many things, but for me, that moment that you watch a cow stand beneath a tree and reach her head up and see her neck extend and start to browse leaves, you suddenly just realise that that's where she's meant to be. And you suddenly sort of connect the dots between cattle, actually, historically, a long time ago, would have existed in these kind of mixed landscapes where there was a lot of tree browse available to them, also open grassland, and that actually would have looked something more savanna-like. And when we talk about the savanna, we often think like open grassland, but actually a savanna landscape has a lot of trees in it, a kind of extended wood pasture, which is something we might be familiar with in the UK. So I think just seeing that it's very much the natural place for cattle to be made me suddenly realise that this was worth looking into more and worth exploring more. And it was kind of by accident. It's only because half of our land at home is woodland that the kind of cattle went in there, because, you know, we've got our species rich meadow that we graze in. And then we've also got the other half of it, which is trees and woodland, and quite a new woodland that was planted outside any sort of forestry grant scheme. It was just planted because the person here liked trees. So it was mixed broadleaf with a little bit of conifer running through it as well. And it meant that we could put the cattle in there because there were no kind of livestock exclusion obligations. And it just started to make sense. And there are very different things to take into account when grazing in woodlands in terms of grass growth. But we can maybe pick up on that later in the podcast. But yeah, it just sort of made sense. And seeing the ability of the cows to take shelter when the weather was really bad. So we don't have sheds. We run an all year round grazing system. So we need to find ways to enable there to be shelter from the wind, from the rain, from the snow, as and when it inevitably comes when you're 400 metres above sea level in the northeast of Scotland. But also seeing the, as I said, the browse, but also the kind of natural behaviours. So it doesn't matter how many fence posts you make available, there will never be anything that's quite at the right angle to get that really annoying itch that's just on a cow's back or just kind of, you know, like below her armpit or something. And so having trees and branches at different angles creates so much more enrichment for the animals to kind of, you know, shed those winter coats, get rid of ticks, and just enjoy a good old scratch against. And you kind of wrap all of that up together and you realize that it's a really healthy high welfare opportunity for the livestock.
I love that sort of open-mindedness and observation of you didn't read this in a book somewhere or you heard somewhere else. It was the cows that told you, actually, we'd like to go into this woodland. And that really encapsulates, I think, the attitude we need to develop these natural capital management processes is to be led by the processes and by the elements of the natural world and see what starts to work and how nature wants to be working and then start to manage our way into that. And someone said there's no, if it works in practice it has to work in theory rather than the other way around. You're seeing all these benefits for the cows. They're getting more interesting food, they're getting shelter, they're getting enrichment. What about the woodland? Is it are they not damaging the woodland? Can they be good for the woodland? What's been the reaction of foresters to hearing that you're overrunning their forests with cows?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I'm not a forester, but what I would say is that, as with all these things, observation is key. So we implement a daily move system. So some people might have heard of that as like mob grazing or adaptive multi-paddock grazing, cell grazing. And that basically means that we use electric fence to separate up grazing blocks and then we move the cattle every single day. And that means that particularly in a more vulnerable setting, like in a woodland, you can have a look at what's going on. And if you think, actually, you know, there's a bit too much damage here, you've only done that in that one tiny section. And you can then move the animal straight out and you can make sure you never come back to that bit because you can kind of protect it, or you don't come back to it for, you know, a year or something. So for me, it's about creating an adaptive approach throughout the whole system, but also using those observation skills to evaluate the impact. So quite often when we think about animal impact, we talk about grazing impact, but actually animals obviously have feet. So there will be a kind of hoof impact and dung and urine and their bodies. They will, particularly in a woodland, you know, if you've got a tree that started to die, they'll quite often in their rubbing, it will, you know, that dead wood will drop and will come down. So they're actually speeding up some of those ecosystem processes and that functioning by getting dead wood onto the ground quicker. But I would say that, yeah, the concern from some folk about putting cattle into trees often takes the assumption that animals will just be chucked in a wood and left. And that, I would say, isn't a great idea. So, yeah, it's very much about being there daily, moving those animals through, keeping them moving on through the woodland, and recognising that, yeah, you might not get the same number of grazing days per hectare because, you know, you've got trees as well as grass, and that the grass growth is going to be affected by the tree presence. That's undeniable. But just being able to understand that and manage that accordingly, as opposed to kind of having a very fixed mindset about it.
Might not be grazing days per hectare, but you're accessing hectares that would previously not have been seen as grazing at all. So you seem to be grazing the wee mob in all sorts of places. They seem to get around Aberdeenshire, is that right? People are inviting you to come and bring the mob to graze.
Yeah, we can't actually meet all of the requests that we get for grazing. We just, right. Yeah, like some, and sometimes people want us to graze quite a small area, and for the amount of effort it takes to get the animals there and move them frequently, it's just not, it doesn't stack up financially. So what we have found is that we now work with two landowners and we have two separate herds now. So we share farm with a neighbour, and about a third of that area is woodland. Probably just over a third, actually. Kind of maybe somewhere between a third and a half of that is woodland that we're grazing in, as well as open pasture. And then we have another organisation that we graze for as well, on the other side of the river, and that's where the wee mob are. And that's a real mixture of grasslands, some woodland, and also kind of going into heathland as well. And actually, that's slightly different because we're starting to plan our first agroforestry planting scheme. So historically, we've always grazed in existing woodland, which is quite different. A lot of people kind of come into agroforestry with the idea of putting trees into pasture, whereas we came at it by putting cows into woodland. So yeah, a slightly different thing. So for us, it's going to be our first opportunity to explore the agroforestry scheme through the forestry grant scheme in Scotland, and to put in some planting this winter, hopefully, to allow us to then have a slightly different setup, and to test that, and to test different planting schemes, and to test different ways of integrating livestock and integrating trees into pasture, and then integrating livestock into that as well.
There has been an agroforestry scheme in Scotland for a wee while, and this year they've improved it because it was very restrictive and not very well funded, and it's now much better, and it's something that we're getting quite excited about. Looking at various clients are looking at making use of it, so yeah, that's certainly something I think we're going to see more of, and there's these opportunities to learn about what's really a totally new discipline. It's not forestry, and it's not exactly farming either, is quite exciting, quite challenging. And so when you get that balance right, you've got not too much and not too little grazing and trampling and nutrient cycling, dung, how does the ground, well, either in the under the trees or in the pasture, what's it look like on the ground? Are you seeing differences in flowers and vegetation and perhaps insects and birds? What does it do to the landscape?
Yeah, definitely.
Having cows. So
we see quite quick changes, actually. Like within a grazing season, we've been able to see quite significant changes in ground flora, particularly in open pasture. And so because the system that we use actually has quite long rest periods, so when the cattle come through a grazing cell, they might not come back to that for 60 days, which is quite a long time to allow flowering plants to do their thing. So we see a lot more opportunity for flowering plants to fully express themselves and to actually flower and go to seed, which then helps us to spread that seed across the pasture. It also means that ground nesting birds have got more places to nest. So it's been fascinating to see actually curlew move from where they used to historically nest and actually starting to nest and feed in other fields that we've been grazing in, which has been really interesting, all of which are surrounded by woodland. So actually, interestingly, we know we often hear that kind of wading birds aren't going to want to be anywhere near trees, but employing this kind of grazing management, we've seen them move away from more open areas and actually start to preferentially breed and feed in areas that are, as I say, surrounded by trees that wouldn't necessarily be your kind of idea or the place that you would identify immediately as curlew ground, for example. So that's been really interesting, seeing that shift, seeing that change. We, as I said, manage the cattle outside all year round. And so we have to be very careful in the winter, particularly it's very wet, about, you know, the impact that these cattle are having on the soil and on soil health. And it just means that we would be moving the animals more quickly. So, you know, lots of people think animals outside in winter equals poaching. And actually, if you're managing, you're observing, you're managing those cattle effectively, you don't really get much poaching at all. You get the odd night where it absolutely buckets down and they're all trying to get a bit of shelter in one particular place and it does get muddy. But the brilliant kind of adaptive nature of these systems means that you just don't bring the cattle back in the next rotation. You just skip that paddock out. So again, it's just giving you that space and that ability to be as adaptive as you possibly can be, not in response to necessarily what's happened, but in order to get the outcomes that you want and to get the outcomes that you're looking to achieve. So increase ground flora, increase bird nesting habitat, etc. So yeah, we definitely see changes. And in woodland, we're starting to see a lot more where they might be knocking over dead trees and we're getting a bit more light coming in, or they're lifting the canopy, actually seeing quite a nice amount of tree regeneration. The biggest challenge that we have is that the deer will come in afterwards and just nip the tops off. So that's really frustrating, that, you know, you're moving a group of ruminants through an area. They're not doing the thing that most people think they would do, which is to eat regenerating growth. And after you've carefully managed this, you take them out and some deer come in. So, yeah, very frustrating.
Yes. That was, in fact, our last podcast was all about deer. So listeners can go and catch up. Deer are a recurring theme. And so I think venison for everybody's tea for a while to come. And then beef. So that's all the good meals at the moment. You're seeing all kinds of nature boxes being ticked. That's really interesting about curlew, because I certainly, as a from forestry end, I knew that there's a, the kind of mantra is curlew don't like being near forests, and actually, whereas we know that around the world they'll live in treed landscapes, and it's interesting to hear that somehow the dynamic that's been created with the cows will encourage them back, and you're doing good things for the pollinators and the invertebrates. Dung beetles, I guess, are just enjoying cows in all sorts of places. So lots of biodiversity benefit, and even trees. Trees far from being damaged by the cows being regenerated by them, so it's sort of win-win for biodiversity. I'm intrigued to know what, if the cows like eat, they're enjoying eating the trees, if they have favorite types of tree. It's quite a different thing from grass for a cow, isn't it? And do they choose their trees, or when you have mixed broadleaves, will they eat anything?
No, they're really picky, and it changes throughout the seasons. And there's some really interesting research that might suggest that this is because of the different nutrient availability in those trees at different times of the year. So, for example, hawthorn, really high in iron during the spring, which is when we're calving. So it makes sense that they might selectively graze hawthorn in the spring to get a higher iron input, because they know that there's, you know, going to be a reduction in iron availability potentially as they're going into calving, and they're going through that quite stressful process. So ash is always a favorite. They love ash. And, you know, there's an argument to try and save ash because of the, you know, the horrors of ash dieback. And one of them would be that it's cattle and sheep both absolutely love it. And so we really try, if there are ash that are self-seeding and are managing to kind of survive here, we're trying to kind of keep them going, because, you know, it creates some resilience in the ash population, and the livestock really do enjoy it. They really seem to love willow most of the year round as well. And even in the winter, will happily eat willow stems. So when the willow's lost its leaves, they will hit willow quite hard and really graze into the stems and into the branches. Which is fine for willow because it bounces back really quickly. So it's amazing actually that, you know, we see plants that are very fast growing, but maybe that's because it's in response to an evolution where they have been grazed really hard and browsed really hard during the winter, because not only are they offering interesting nutrient availability in terms of minerals, but also things like salicylic acid, which is a, you know, natural painkiller, and it's the, you know, as we all know, is really, you know, kind of where aspirin comes from. So yeah, different trees at different times. We have to be a bit careful. Things like oak, again, there's research to suggest that oak, and particularly acorns, can be very poisonous. But we do notice that our cattle will eat oak leaves, and that's either generally in the spring or in the autumn. And it's really interesting. In the spring, they're obviously quite leafy green. They aren't too high in tannins, so maybe they're less bitter. As they eat them in the autumn, they're much higher in tannins, but potentially that's a point where you're going to get increased worm risk. And we know that high tannin plants can help to reduce anthelmintic worms. So can reduce intestinal worms, which reduces our need for anthelmintic medication. So when you just stand back and watch this stuff, you suddenly realize like nature's got this. She knows what she's doing. Animals have evolved and we've only kind of messed it up because we've tried to interfere too much and we've stopped looking, we've stopped observing and we've stopped noticing. So yeah, there are definitely different types of trees, definitely favored at different times of year. And the link between that and the nutritional quality of the leaf browse, I think is really fascinating.
And what about the cows themselves? Is the right kind of cow an important factor? What kind of what breed of cows do you use and how did you choose those?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really stick to this line that like certain breeds are better than other breeds. There's definitely a relevance to particular breeds for particular systems, but actually, I mean, quite often, you know, there's this kind of suggestion that there's more variation within breed than between breeds genetically, and actually it's about selecting the right stock for your system. So in our system we run two herds, the Wee Mob, which is predominantly Shetland, but we've also got some Galloway in there as well, and we chose those because they were a rare native breed and they're dual purpose, and they clearly, and they're quite small, so they're really great for kind of the grazing systems that we're running because they're not too big. They also produce phenomenal beef. And then in our other system, we have pedigree Angus, and we're trying to bring as much native Angus into genetics into that herd as possible to keep the size, frame size down, a more hardy animal. So though, you know, native breeds generally are going to do well because they evolved in these places. But at the same time, you know, I've got friends who have got herds that have got Solaire in them, you know, not a native breed, but the selections they've been making into those genetics has meant that those animals are able to thrive in the settings that they're in. So yeah, I think I wouldn't want to go and put like a massive Charolais bull into our system, but at the same time, all of those animals, Charolais, Limousins, you know, these continentals, all were native somewhere, and the places where they were native are not that dissimilar to some of our uplands, particularly things like a Simmental cow. I think sometimes we kind of wrap ourselves in knots about which is the best breed, but actually it's about the selections you're making to the genetics that you have, and then selecting out the animals that thrive with as little input as possible, which inevitably is going to kind of help you to be more profitable as well.
Yeah, it always feels like we're kind of starting small in many ways in UK land use. We've got quite small amounts of woodland, small systems, small farms, and the small animals are part of that. And maybe when we have much bigger, wilder, more joined up landscapes, we can start to bring in the Charolais bulls and they can roam around in them. But it's going to... So all together on a bigger scale, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think they need to have been selected for the traits that we're looking for. So if, you know, bringing an animal that's been fed a very concentrate or grain rich diet, and it's been bred from animals that had that same diet, which has been bred from animals that have had that same diet, you put it in a wood and don't give it any concentrate, it's going to melt, and that's not going to be a good thing for welfare. However, if we start selecting different genetics from those breeds, so that we can maybe not have to get rid of a whole herd and we can just transition our existing herd into a lower input system and we just start selecting slightly differently, then that's definitely an option. I just think, yeah, I wouldn't want anyone to sort of think, oh, well, I've got these particular animals, so I can't possibly do that. And I think the other thing is it's about doing things little, you know, just like you said, on a small scale, but that's better than nothing. So if you've got a farm with some woodland and you don't have any livestock exclusion obligations on that wood, and you've got a herd of whatever cattle they are, then, you know, on a really wet, miserable day, just chuck them in there or just put them in for a couple of days and see what happens, you know. And the worst that's going to happen is, well, they might escape. They might, you know, make sure you've got good fences around. But, you know, you could just pop them in there for a bit and see what happens. And, you know, they don't have really high expectations that it's going to completely transition your whole system, but it might just give you, on a really hot summer's day, a little bit of comfort that those animals have got some shade. So I think, yeah, there's lots of ways that farmers, landowners can have a go at this stuff without kind of committing to whole scale system change.
people listening who might be thinking about the sustainability of beef and what about the carbon footprint of beef, and touched on there the difference in diet between beef around the world is so variable in how it's produced. What's your take on that whole question of beef sustainability and the part that you're playing in what you're doing for the point of view of the product at the end?
Sure. Well, you know, ruminants evolved to eat grass, and it's a phenomenal thing that these really big animals were evolved to get to that size and produce young from basically salad leaves. Like, that's really impressive. And they've got this incredible dietary mechanism in the rumen that allows them to do that. And I think from my point of view, you know, and this is a very personal view, that what we need to be doing is optimizing that capacity of ruminants to eat what we're really great at growing in the UK, which is grass. You know, and I think that I was at a research event last week talking about, you know, should we have ruminants in places where it's really difficult to grow grass? Maybe we shouldn't. And maybe we should just have ruminants rather than all the other different animals in places where we can really definitely grow grass. So whilst there is this argument that, you know, in the UK we have a lot of ruminants on the west and we've got arable on the east, and that we need to kind of integrate these things better. But if that means that we end up feeding ruminants human appropriate food, then maybe there isn't an argument for that. So I think, you know, these are really complex challenges, and these aren't things that you can just apply a simple rule to fix. These are, you know, complex issues with wicked problems, and, you know, really often what can feel like contradictory solutions. So for me, the primary thing with ruminant livestock is that they should be pasture fed, because that's what they evolved to eat. And what we shouldn't be doing is using land that can grow human edible food, so arable land, we shouldn't be using that to feed to an animal that can actually get to the size it needs to be and perform the way it needs to off pasture. Pasture's brilliant because it's got loads and loads of carbon locked into the soil underneath it, so we don't want to be disturbing that. Arable soils, we know, have been degraded for many, many years. So if we're going to degrade soils and we're going to do all of that stuff to them, and there's significant changes happening thanks to, you know, reduced tillage operations and cover crops and all of those things, but let's put all that effort into growing human edible protein or human edible foods and leave our ruminants on pasture. So that's one aspect of it. The other thing is methane emissions. Now, methane is just cycling. Fossil fuels is constantly being added to. It's not cycling, it's just addition, addition, addition. So every time we burn fossil fuels, we're adding to that carbon load in the atmosphere. When we are grazing livestock, we are just cycling the methane that it was already here, and we have amazing things called methanotrophs, which are bacteria that live in and around the soil, which are able to kind of manage some of that methane in these pastured systems. So actually, the ability of the Earth's natural resources and ecosystems to cycle is phenomenal. And we've kind of disrupted that because we create systems that just load rather than enabling cycling. And then when we load, 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 the natural systems can't then cycle what was already there. So there's two parts there. There's grass-fed. There's also the kind of nutrient cycling and energy cycling, methane cycling as opposed to loading. And then I think finally, you know, what we need to do is just be far more, as humans, kind of conscious of the decisions that we're making. And it's hard work, right? Going into the supermarket. I mean, ideally, we wouldn't shop in supermarkets, but we're all exhausted and we all work full-time jobs. And so it's just easier to nip into Tesco's or other supermarkets are available at the end of the day and, you know, just buy stuff off the shelves. And it is hard work to interrogate every single item that you're buying. But if we really started to understand the environmental, the social, the emissions impact of everything that we are putting into our bodies, we'd probably think quite differently about the products that we buy, which is why eating whole foods, shopping direct, all of those things are kind of routes that you can take to reduce your overall footprint. So sorry, I've probably gone on a bit of a rant there, but yeah.
No, it's a
pet subject.
Yes, I know it's a wicked problem is the word, but it's something that I get asked about a lot, and something I'm sure is in mind. That was a really good answer. And where does your produce end up? What happens to the cows?
Yeah, so we sell all of our beef direct, and we sell that as 100% pasture and tree-fed beef. And that goes predominantly to our local community. So I have a couple of customers in Glasgow and Edinburgh, but that's predominantly because they quite enjoy offal, and so they'll take like a lot of offal and they'll take quite a big order. But generally everything gets sold locally, mostly within our postcode area. So we really enjoy selling locally. It's really great to know that people in our local community are eating the food that we're producing. As our business grows and we have more animals, we're going to have to start thinking a bit differently about that, because I think that our supply will be more than the local demand we currently have. That's also to do with my inability to be a very good marketing and salesperson of our product. So most of it is through word of mouth and just building up that customer base. So we always sell out with beef, but to expand beyond that and to like double the size of customers would take quite a lot of resource for in terms of marketing and things. So yeah, that's something that we have to think about in the coming years about how we're going to address that. But everything does go, as I said, directly to the people that are eating it.
Yeah, and so those of us who are living everywhere else, we need a lot more of people like you to be able to feed people like us. That leads on very well to the next question I was going to ask, which is about the commerciality of this. We know that a lot of Scottish livestock farms are very dependent on subsidies, and that it's very hard to make profits, and you're doing something that's more complicated and difficult than other people. Is it easier or harder or different to make this profitable, and what things need to change to make it more commercial for farmers to work in this way? And maybe marketing is an example of something where there's a kind of intervention that's needed that would really support other things.
Yeah, I don't think I agree that it's more complicated. I think it's different. Like, I couldn't imagine the utter stress of like bringing animals in several times a year to dose them with various things. I can't imagine having to house animals and drive tractors and various other bits of equipment through there to clean that out or to feed. Like, to me, that is utter nightmare, complicated, difficult, hard. I know some people love it, but for me personally, too difficult, don't want to do it. So the complexity of the system, actually, our system is incredibly simple. Animals go out at grass, they're at grass all year round. We feed a little bit of hay in the winter when it's like 3 foot of snow on the ground, but generally it's either growing grass or deferred grazing. They all calve in a 6 week block in spring when there's grass on the ground, and like, that's it. And yes, they're being moved every day, but because of that, we're able to pick up problems quickly, we're being able to see issues. So we farm, our system is profitable without subsidy. But the only reason that it's profitable without subsidy is the way that we access land. And so we work with landowners to provide them a ecological engineering service. So we've just had to be a bit creative. So we couldn't afford to buy the sort of land that we want. Renting land around here is really difficult. There are particular farms who have a monopoly on that, and that's fine. That's their business. And that's, you know, I'm not going to get annoyed that somebody else took an opportunity that I couldn't take. But so we've decided to work in a slightly different way, where we're adding value to the business by bringing in additional skills that we can go to a landowner and say, right, we will use our cattle to help you achieve the outcomes that you want to gain. And whether that some of those landowners claim subsidy, but that's nothing to do with us, and it actually has nothing to do with the operations on that land, and some don't. And so therefore, you know, that subsidy that's being paid is kind of not relevant to our part of our business. And so it's just being a bit creative and finding different ways of working. And we're seeing some really nice examples of this. Across Scotland, people are slightly kind of slowly coming around to the idea of joint venture, share farming, you know, different ways of working. And I think we need more space for that creativity to happen, which will inevitably enable farms to become more resilient as we go forward. And, you know, we are seeing farm tenancies, when they come to an end, farms are going back in hand to the estate owner, for example. And I think that's because estates are thinking very much about natural capital, and they're concerned that a tenant isn't going to value, for example. I'm not saying this is always the case, but the tenant might not see the potential for that natural capital as the landowner does, because ultimately it's their asset, it's the thing that they own. And so I think we are seeing some changes now happening in land access, But I do think it's an opportunity, and it's an opportunity for new entrants to come in and create alternative ways of thinking about how you access land. So I think for farms that are kind of locked in to an existing pathway or system, then yeah, asking them to change is a big step, but little changes. So actually, if we can use agroforestry or mob grazing to extend the average suckler herd grazing season by 2 weeks at either side, so they get out 2 weeks earlier and they stay out 2 weeks later, that's a whole month of costs that you strip out of the business. Like, wintering costs are high. So we can strip out a month of wintering costs just by extending that grazing season. Suddenly that could be a game changer. And we're seeing some farms, I run a field lab of farms that are looking at bale grazing, which is an outwintering method. And one of those, in 1 year of shifting to bale grazing, saved 26 grand. Well, they could employ another person with that if they wanted to. So suddenly the opportunities of money saving do come if you just make those tweaks and changes to the system, but that you have the community around you to help you do that and not feel like you're on your own and that you're putting everything at risk, but you're making small changes that could have significant gains later on.
Yes, I find it really revolutionary that all our lives we've kind of heard the kind of received wisdom is to farm you need land and you need access to land, and the only way to get more farmers is to sort of divide up the land into smaller portions. And you've completely turned that around and said, no, I don't need land, I need cows, and I can need access, but you're providing a service and doing it in a new and different way. And you feel there's lots more scope for lots more land-based businesses without having to struggle with policy or land ownership, all the other things that are really out of our immediate control. You've found an opportunity. How is the farming and forestry and land management sector reacting? Do they see you as an exciting pioneer role model, or as a bit of a threat, a bit of a maverick? What's the reaction been?
God, you'd have to ask other people probably, but I probably mixed. I think some people get really excited that there's an opportunity. You know, they see somebody doing something that they want to do, like having access to land and doing it in a way that is, you know, not traditional. I think some people get quite intimidated and frightened by it because it's different. You know, I'm not backward in coming forward, and I think that probably rubs some people up the wrong way, but I'm really passionate about what we do, and I've always tried to be open and honest about things that go wrong as well. I think that it's important to kind of have a voice and to demonstrate an alternative. I mean, there was a really fascinating, BBC came out to see me early in the year and they interviewed me, and then they interviewed another local farmer. And my message was like, this is a great opportunity. You know, things are changing within policy. What we need to do is make sure that, you know, that we can be profitable from kind of biodiversity-based farming approaches, so that we can address those multiple aims of climate, biodiversity loss, human health, but also challenges around mental health within the rural communities, health and safety, all of those sorts of things, rural population and economic kind of viability. And, you know, that we can generate that and we can kind of work in collaboration to make those things happen. And the kind of the other guy that was interviewed was kind of, you know, quite negative about policy and sort of saying, you know, we can't cope without these subsidies and that we need to have this money given to us by government to make sure that we're viable. And so I think, you know, there's always going to be both sides to that debate and different people having a different view on it, but we have to make sure that there is a debate and that it's not just received wisdom or an accepted way of thinking that farming is X, when actually farming can be A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, and there are all these other ways of doing things. So all I ever want to do is put options on the table and say, you know, we own 18 acres, most of which is woodland and a bit of bog, but we can produce food to feed our local community in a way that is environmentally beneficial, not just benign, but actually is kind of net gains to biodiversity and soil health. And I just worry sometimes that the farming voice is quite negative and a bit kind of, either seems to say farming's amazing, we don't need to change, or it says everything's terrible and we need lots of handouts. And actually there's a massive range in between all of that that is probably closer to reality. And sometimes I don't think we quite get the messaging right. So all I try and do is tweak that message.
Yeah, you can't be a positive and can-do opportunity message. in my view. So I think we're starting to come to the end of our time, but I'm conscious I haven't asked you about your research, and I would like to, I've got so excited by the cows and the trees. I would like to hear a little bit about your research and what that's all about.
Yeah, so I guess I'm engaged with research in different ways. So with Pasture for Life, we're predominantly involved in two big research projects. One is called ReLivestock, and that's looking at resilient livestock systems across Europe. So that's a big multi-actor kind of collaboration across lots of different European countries, looking at, you know, what does resilience look like? So for us, we're interested in sward types and diversity, and how grazing systems on different sward types can help build more resilient farms, given that we go through periods of extreme wet weather to extreme drought, and it's all kind of, you know, no one really knows what the weather's like anymore. It just seems to be bonkers all the time. So that's one project we're involved in. We're also involved in a project called Pathways, and I've just come back from the most recent kind of big collaborative meeting around that. And we're looking at what are sustainable pathways for livestock across Europe in 2050 that meet a number of metrics relating to greenhouse gas emissions, to human health, to other environmental indicators like ecological indicators, water quality. And we're also looking at kind of social justice around that as well. So they're kind of these complex scenarios for the best livestock system going forward. And then my own reason, and then we do kind of a lot of farmer scale, like field scale or farmer related research and field labs and things as well. So that's what I'm doing with Pasture for Life. And then my own research, my PhD, is looking at the role that nature connectivity has in influencing farmer decisions around the direction which they take their farm, particularly given the kind of complex political situation we're in at the moment, where things are changing but it's all a bit confusing, and you know, no one really knows what's going on or if it's going to stay, and kind of exploring how, you know, in Wales that's very different to England, which is very different again to Scotland. So yeah, interested in particularly those farmers that are engaged in peer-to-peer support kind of groups and learning opportunities, and how they are learning from each other and how they're sharing their knowledge and how that drives their connection with nature and what that does to the decision-making on farm, particularly how that changes what their farm looks like, feels like, and how profitable it is. So, yeah, hopefully my PhD kind of examining will be as simple as that, and I'll just say that and I'll go, brilliant, there you go, Dr. Yoxall, off you go. I don't think it will be. I'll have to be far more complex than what I say.
Well, I would pass you. And it sounds really useful for people like us at Galbraith. One of our roles is advising land managers, and to have that kind of evidence-based research saying, yeah, exploring these things is really useful tools for people like us. So thank you. Look forward to being able to read the PhD just before handing back to Matt. I've sort of had a few of these through the podcast, but I'm interested to know what your kind of top takeaway tips for things for landowners to think about, but especially for listeners who are perhaps owning part of businesses which aren't connected to the land, or who are thinking, what can they do as individuals or in policy? What would be your kind of top takeaway tips for how they can help to support and promote and generate more of the kind of thing that you're doing in their work?
Yeah, well, I guess all of us have to eat. So being a kind of conscientious consumer, I think, is really important. And if you have the means, both in terms of financial, but also just the capacity and the ability to make decisions, and you're not kind of completely exhausted every day and you just need to eat whatever's put in front of you, I think, you know, because it's complex, right? It's very easy to say you just all need to go and like shop in your local butcher and eat food from your local market garden. But for some people that just isn't realistic. So if it is realistic for you to be able to do that, or even just a part of that, then I would always recommend that consumers play their role in kind of putting money into the systems that they think are ideal. So, you know, ask questions, go and shop local if you can, even if it's just going to like the local farmers market once a year and making a decision to buy some chutney that somebody locally has made. You know, just those little decisions all help to contribute to different ways of producing and selling food. So that's the first thing. And I think the next thing is about, we need our policymakers to have faith and confidence in us, and for there to be flex in the system when it is obvious that the person who's trying to implement change has the ability to adequately monitor and adapt in relation to what they're trying to do. So, you know, this comes back to this thing of the fear, like livestock exclusion or forestry planting, because people think, and this is a lack of joined upness, foresters think farmers are just going to put animals in there and, you know, bugger off for 6 months and eat, and then the livestock will eat all the trees. Actually, there are lots of mitigation strategies that you can put in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so a bit of faith and trust from those developing the policy structures and the implementation of that, so that there are mechanisms for people like me to say, well, we could graze in there, but we're just going to use some electric fencing and we're going to do this, and this is how often we're going to monitor, and if it goes wrong, this is what our response will be. And to understand that every case is different, because we can't have, you know, not every case is the same. We all know that. We all bang on about how, you know, every farmer is an expert on their farm and everything's context specific. But then we have policy that treats every farm as if it's paint by numbers, or every land holding as if it's paint by numbers. So we need to be able to see a joined upness between the intent for creativity and autonomy and the policy mechanisms to allow that to happen.
Yeah, and there was some interesting research came out just recently, which might be a really good subject for a future podcast, about the I've forgotten the term, but the sort of policy and non-indirect challenges for ecological restoration. And it's all these things like just the way we do statistics, and we measure areas of forestry and we measure areas of farmland, and if you start putting them in the same place, how do you measure it anymore? And the way our policy agencies have developed, you've got forestry managed by one part of the Scottish government and farming by another part, and all these things that are social and cultural that actually change our landscapes, and they're barriers that we all start to run up against. So I think there are potentially interesting things that can be done that are really nothing to do with the land and are much more to do with society and some quite big and deep questions. I think we are starting to run out of time, so thank you very much indeed. That was it was really interesting to talk to you, and one day I will do hope I can come and visit a farm in person. We did have an original idea of recording this on site, but it was all too complicated, so here we are online, but I would love to come and visit and see the cows and the trees in action. And yeah, thank you very much. I'm sure hand back to Matt.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me as well. I really appreciate the opportunity to always talk about cows and trees. So yeah, it's been great to have a chat.
Before you leave us though, Nikki, how can listeners get in touch with you if they have any questions or want to know more about your work?
Sure. So either you can get in touch with me through Pasture for Life, and you can use the website to kind of use the contact us and get in touch there. Or if you're particularly interested more in the grazing side of things, you can go to Grumpy and Graziers, so Graziers, not Grazers, .co.uk, and get in touch that way. And you'll be able to see some nice photos of cows on that website as well. Oh, you can also find me on Twitter, sorry, at Howmill, which is how most people seem to find me. So yeah, at Howemill on Twitter.
Excellent. Well, we'll make sure that listeners end up on Twitter, and I know your Instagram as well is quite popular too. There's a lot of photos of nice cows under the trees as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm just Nikki Yoxall on Instagram. I'm more active on Twitter, but yeah, if you want nice photos of cows, then head to Instagram as well.
Excellent. Well, remember that you can listen back to all previous episodes of Galbraith Podcasts, and make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'd love to get feedback from you, the listener. If you have any questions for Eleanor for any future episodes, please get in touch. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, X, Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok and Threads, all at Galbraith Group. Thank you again for joining us today, Nikki. How did you find that experience?
Yeah, it was great. It's grand.
Excellent. And Eleanor, as always, thank you very much. We'll be back soon with another episode, I'm sure.
Yes. Always great. Looking forward to the next one.
Excellent. Well, thank you for listening, and thank you as always for your continued support. I've been Matt Finlay. She's been Eleanor Harris, and this has been Galbraith Podcasts.